You're listening to the Mojo Matters podcast, episode 30. Hi, it's Jo here. And just before we get on to the main part of the show, I've got exciting news. Over the last year, I've been researching, training and applying the neuroscience to help people like you harness your mojo and find your edge to achieve incredible results in your personal and professional lives. And so I've decided to give away even more free resources to help you through my weekly e-newsletter. To subscribe, just email jo@pacedevelopment.co.uk. That's jo@pacedevelopment.co.uk. And now on to the main part of the show. You're listening to the Mojo Matters podcast with me, your host, Jo Britton. Your mojo is your energy, your enthusiasm, and your motivation so that you've got the ability to get results for your personal and professional life without freaking out and burning out. Tune in for practical advice on how to find your mojo and keep it. Welcome back to another episode. We're going to be talking about high performance so that you can learn lessons and techniques that you can apply to your own life, whether that's personally or professionally, or to your business if you have one, and without holding back and burning yourself out. So I couldn't be more excited to have landed my guest to talk about this with. He's co-host of the chart-topping and highly acclaimed High Performance podcast, where he's interviewed elite performers from business, sport and the arts, exploring the psychology behind sustained high performance. He's author of 8 best-selling business books. I've read pretty much all of them, and that's amazing. He's an international speaker who combines his practical and academic background within sport, organizational development and change psychology to help organizations and teams create high performance cultures. And he's professor of organizational change and psychology at Manchester Metropolitan University, a fellow Mancunian. And as we'd say in Manchester, a really sound bloke, incredibly humble and someone I admire massively, both as a thoroughly decent human being and for his work. I'm joined by Professor Damien Hughes. Welcome to the show, Damien.
Thanks for having me, Jo. It's a real treat. And what you haven't mentioned there is we've known each other a long time, haven't we? And I'm really delighted to be on because I know how brilliant you are, but how brilliant this podcast is. So thank you for having me. It's a real treat to be on and chatting with you again.
That is so nice of you to say. Thank you. So look, you've been having enormous success with your High Performance podcast, and you've been interviewing so many elite achievers and performers from all sorts of fields, so from sport and business and the arts and so on. So I'm dying to ask you, can we start with the question that you ask each of your guests at the start of your podcast, particularly as you've heard so many responses to this? Can we start with, Damien, what is high performance?
It's a brilliant question, and that's not because we ask it at the start. It's just, the reason I think it's a brilliant question, Jo, is that we've not had one consistent answer. We've done over 50 of these interviews now, and there's not been one consistent answer from it. And I think what that tells you is that there's no fixed definition. There's no sort of reference point in a book that you can go, that's what it counts. So some people think it's about trophies. Some people think it's about your bank balance or the size of your house or the car you drive, which might be right for some people. Other people think it's about the impact you leave on others' lives or the difference you make, which might be right for them as well. And I think that's a really important point, that there is no definition, that you can't succeed or fail unless it's against what you've defined it to be. But to answer the question for myself, I think I've changed over the course of the series that we've done of the High Performance podcast. I think initially I thought it was about sort of having trophies in the cabinet or runs on the board or whatever. But I think where I've reached a place that's comfortable for me is, it's a 13-word phrase that says, do the best you can with what you've got in the moment you're in. And that really resonates for me, that, because it says, you might look back and you know, there's that old saying that hindsight is the foresight of a gobshite, that we're all looking back and going, I'd have done it differently. Or, yeah. But I think when you look back and go, no, in the moment I was in with the knowledge I had, that was the best I could do. That to me is high performance, because that leaves yourself open to the possibility that I can get better, I can improve, maybe I'd do it differently. But in that moment, I went all in. I gave everything I could to do the best that I was capable of. That to me is high performance. And you can apply that whether you're a parent, whether you're a partner, whether you're in a professional context. The question is, am I doing that? And if the answer is an honest yes, I am, that's high performance then, on your own terms, not on anyone else's.
Wow. That's really amazing. It's really profound as well. And I would never have thought about it like that before, because you're right. I often think of this like they're a high achiever, they're elite, they're a high performer. It's kind of like, for me, I always kind of think about it as, can I keep raising my game even if times are tough? Can I kind of unleash like my personal potential, and can I keep improving myself, and kind of pick myself up when shit hits the fan? And for me, that's what it is. And I'm kind of sensing that as well, because the question also that I wanted to ask you was, because lots of people might just think about, well, it's for all these, you know, you see all the elite athletes and so on. And maybe it's, are we hardwired, you know, as individuals to be high performers or not? Is it kind of part of our DNA? Is it, you know, inherent talent that we have, or is it like other things that we can nurture and we can learn?
Massively. I think that it depends on the domain that you're in. I think it's a really smart question that you've thrown at us there, Joe, because I think that we're all talented. One of my academic heroes is a bloke called Howard Gardner, and he's an educational psychologist, and I like him because he's a provocateur, but he asks a brilliant question. He says, rather than ask people, how clever are you? The question every one of us should be able to answer is, how are you clever? Because we're all clever, but we're all clever in different ways.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure, think about your friendship group. I bet you've got some mates that are really good at numbers, some that might be musically gifted, some that might be socially gifted, some that might be really gifted in the garden. Like, there's different intelligences, is what this guy Howard Gardner says. And the point is, if we only assess somebody's intelligence through a narrow boundary of how good are you at reading and writing, how many kids left school thinking they were thick, when the reality was you weren't thick, you just hadn't found a way of engaging you? So we're all talented, so it depends on the domain in which you want to then express that talent. Like, we interviewed, there's a brilliant story of a lady we interviewed recently on the podcast. I mean, it's not been released yet, but she's a lady called Christine Wellington, right? And she was like quite an academic go-getter, went to university in Birmingham, did a master's in Manchester, went to work as a civil servant doing sort of like sustainable cultures. And at 23, she ran a marathon for a charity that she was doing. She was expected to come in about 4 hours. She broke the 3-hour barrier, and people went, oh, I think you've got something in this. She was 27 before she sat on a bike, right? She ended up becoming the world Ironman champion for 4 years in a row.
Wow.
And yet she hadn't ridden a bike before she was 27. So she had this latent physiological talent for endurance sports that could have lay hidden unless she'd have just gone, you know what, I'm going to have a go. So yeah. I think talent is such a subjective term. Everybody's talented, but it's about, do you know what you're good at, and do you then get a chance to express it, is the first factor. But then beyond that, I'm reminded of a quote that many years ago, I did a book where I was back and forth from Barcelona at the football club there. And I met a fella called Cheeky Bagheerestein, that he was... he was a Basque, but he was almost like a nationalized Catalan. And he was a director of football at Barcelona. He does a job now for City over here. And I was asking him about how he selects. And he had a brilliant line that I take with me so many places. He goes, your talent will get you as far as a dressing room door at Barcelona. How you behave will determine whether we keep you in there or not. So the point he was making was that when you get to a certain level of competition, talent equals out. Everybody's roughly as fit and as fast and as strong as each other. So everybody's as good as each other. So then it's about how do you conduct yourself? How do you behave? How do you treat others with respect? What's your attitude to timekeeping? How do you develop? What's self-development like in your world? And it's all those behaviours that then say, are you making the most of what you've got? Are you squeezing the most out of that talent and giving that talent the best chance to perform? So I'm conscious of giving you a long-winded answer there, Joe, but I think the point is, first of all, I think we're all talented in different ways, and it's about discovering what that is. But then understanding that talent isn't just enough. It's about how you conduct yourself and how you utilize it and all the other things that surround talent that is just as significant.
So behavior, picking up on that, behavior. So whatever it is, what is it that you've noticed as well about people that seem to be able to sustain high levels of performance and their behavior? Is it like habits that they develop? Do they work to like a process, a system? Do they share particular values and behaviors? What have you noticed when you've spoken to all these people that seem to just keep achieving at a high level?
Yeah, again, it's really interesting. I think, everybody's coming at this from a different perspective, but I do think there is some common ground. Like when I've reflected on, well, what do all these people have in common? I think the ones that have sustained high performance, one of the first things I'd say is almost like, and it's such a quiet virtue that if you're not looking for it, you could almost miss it or misinterpret it. But it's about they have a mindset of humility. Now, I'm conscious that humility is one of these phrases that gets bandied around an awful lot. Like I'm sure you've seen posts on social media like I have, where it's somebody standing in front of a posh car telling you how down to earth they are, or standing in front of like a big house that they own and saying that, oh, I'm same as you. Humility isn't a meme or a cliche or a social media post. It's a proper mindset. And what I've seen is there's three stages to developing it when I speak to them about this mindset of humility. That the first stage is they get beyond what I call peak idiot stage. And what peak idiot stage is, I'll give you a really simple example. You know, like when you're ever watching a football match with somebody and they sit there and go, I could do a better job than him.
Yeah.
And you go, look into football for years, mate. Like you're physically out of shape and yet you sat there.
Yeah.
In these young athletes suggesting that you'd be better than them, or when they go, what mistake that coach would have made, I'd have done something different. Peak idiot stage. It's like when the example I often use is, you know, like when programs like X Factor or Britain's Got Talent take place, and the early stages is the only bits of that I'll ever watch if it's on the telly. You know, when you get someone turning up and they go, oh, they're being interviewed and they go, oh, I'm the next Mariah Carey.
Yeah.
They sort of talk themselves up and then they stand in front of the judges and they sound like a cat being strangled. Like, that's funny. But the reason it's funny is because it's peak idiot stage that they don't realise how bad they are to understand how far away from excellent they're operating.
Mm.
So they're deluded. So, but what's interesting is when we've interviewed these guys, I'll give you a really simple example. We interviewed this bloke called Dylan Hartley that was the England Rugby Union captain. And he's telling us all about how he sort of sustained a high performance career in rugby union for years. And then during the interview, I knew that he'd recently become a dad. So I said, how are you teaching your kids this sort of stuff? And that was the moment where he recognized we're outside his range of expertise. So he went, I don't know, mate, I've never been a dad. I'm learning how to be a dad. So he didn't immediately assume, because he was an expert at one thing, it made him an expert at everything.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? So he immediately went into the second stage of what I call this mindset, which is the valley of humility. And the valley of humility is basically, it's characterized by being curious, giving things a go, getting it wrong and working out why did I get it wrong and going again. So all the stuff that I know you do on like with this podcast and the coaching work that you're doing, you're taking people into that valley of humility and you're going with them to help them understand their potential and how they can explore that. And then the third stage is you get to what I call the hill of knowledge. And the hill of knowledge is where you have a, like, you have an appreciation of your craft. You know why you're good at it and you know where you can get better. So you're never afraid to go back down the hill into the valley to learn more or to pick up new insights and take them back to your, like, your craft and apply them. So if there was a common trend with all of these guys, is they've got beyond peak idiot stage very quickly, and they've entered this stage of humility and curiosity and open-mindedness that then they take and they apply. But they also know where that expertise ends, that they don't, like, I'm sure you've met people like I have, Joe, that, you know, like, these people that might have been successful in one domain of the life, like they might have been a successful businessman, and then they start pronouncing with expertise on politics or on sport or on other areas, where you go, hang on, just because you've been successful as a businessman doesn't now immediately make you a leading politician or make you understand that sporting context. But they don't recognize the importance of that mindset of humility, of going in and not offering opinion, but seeking empathy and understanding. So that's a big thing that I've seen. Another factor that I've recognized is that they focus relentlessly on how they show up when they're at the best, which I know is a big theme of your podcast and your coaching work. But what I mean by that is it's not an occasional thing. It's an everyday thing. So when you talk about routines and habits, that there's certain things they won't compromise on. So again, I'll give you a really quick story on it. But when we're doing one of our, we're doing the day of interviews and we're in the Northern Quarter in Manchester. And I struggled finding the studio. It was up, it was in one of the back streets, up some staircase, and it wasn't easy to find. And like both of us, we live in Manchester, so we're familiar with the area. So anyway, we get there. First appointed time is 10 o'clock. First interview time is 10 o'clock. 10 to 10 on this morning, there's a knock on the door. So I go and open the door, and standing outside, Chris Hoy, Britain's greatest ever Olympian. So I've never met him before. So I introduced myself and we're sort of having a chat, making a bit of small talk. And I went, oh, thanks for turning up early, Chris. It just makes the rest of the day go so much smoother when we're on time. And he bristled and took offense. And I went, hey, I didn't mean any offense, Chris. I'm just saying thank you. Just giving you a bit of context, appreciation. And he went, well, why would I not turn up early? And it was like, well, appreciate that. And then he explained it. I asked him why. And he said, if I was to show up later than what we planned, that would indicate, I think, that my time is more important than yours. Mm-hmm. If I just show up late when it suits me. He said, so that would imply that I think I'm more important than you are. And he said, and I don't think that. He said, I'd be here for 10 o'clock, 10 to 10 is the minimum. Now, one of the questions we ask people in the podcast is, what are your non-negotiable behaviours?
Yeah.
And when we ask Chris Hoy that, it'd be no surprise, he comes back and goes, respect, humility and commitment. Now, in that one anecdote I've just told you, all three of those behaviours are on display. Respect for other people and their time. Humility, not to walk around thinking because you've got 8 Olympic gold medals in your back pocket, that buys you any extra kudos in the outside world. And the commitment, do what you say you'll do.
Yeah.
Now, in that one anecdote, that's a guy that he'd been retired 8 years by the time he's talking this to us, but he's still living those behaviours relentlessly in every situation. Now, there's a great saying in sort of, it tends to be in like elite military environments that says, when you come under pressure, you don't rise to the performance, you descend to where you spend most of your time in training.
Yeah.
So in that one example of Chris Hoy showing that, you go, do I think that those kind of attributes would have helped him win the 8 Olympic gold medals? He'd go, they were the foundations of exactly what it was. Respect for your competitors, humility to go and work hard and keep developing. And then the commitment of, if I said I'm going to do it, I'm going to follow through and do it. So it's almost like this relentless focus on showing up at your best and not compromising on that and not allowing others around you to compromise on it as well.
I love that. And it sounds like it's setting standards and expectations of yourself and meeting them consistently and having that self-discipline and respect for yourself and other people around you to keep showing up and to keep doing your level best all the time.
100%. So when people then go, Like people often just use a shorthand and say, oh, that's character, he's a good character, or she's a good character. And you go, well, it's not. What it is it's about being transparent. These are my standards, and then consistent. And these are the standards that I'll apply in every situation. So it's not an occasional thing of if I'm having a good day, I'll turn up on time. But if I'm having a shocker, I might be late. No, that's every day. That's the standard you're going to get off me. So it's almost that then drives consistency. And what we've found is consistency is far more valuable than intensity. Yes. You can focus for 5 minutes, but the guy that can focus for a whole day, he's going to deliver more than the one that switches on and off. So it's almost about that idea of just of being really clear about what you stand for and then just living up to that.
Yeah. So that sounds like a couple of things to me. Being clear about what you stand for suggests like really being aware of your values and what matters to you. How much do values come into play in terms of your performance?
Well, I mean, you're asking some brilliant questions here, Joe. I think value, the way I interpret it is your behaviours are your values in action.
Yeah.
So what I mean by that is how you show up tells me something about the values that you hold intrinsically. So a value is deep and it's personal, but it's intrinsic. So I could tell you, I believe in fairness, and being fair and justice is a value for me. But unless you see me in a situation where there is a lack of fairness and you watch how I behave, you don't know whether that's bullshit or not. Yeah. I could just be saying it because it's almost like virtue signaling. Oh, I believe in equality for all. And unless you put me in a situation where there is inequality, how do you know?
Yeah.
A behavior, though, gives you evidence. Do you know what I mean? A behavior, because I can show up and I could say I believe in treating people with respect and courtesy. Well, how I treat you indicates whether I'm living my values or not.
Yeah.
So a value is deep and personal, but I think you then have to translate it into a behavior. How does that manifest itself? What does that look like to the rest of the world? Because again, if I know we might touch on culture later on, but when you talk about culture, that one of the big things that I advocate for people is challenge. So feedback on behaviors, not personality. So if we've agreed a certain behavior and I say to you, Joe, I don't like your timekeeping. I think that when you show up late for a meeting, I consider it disrespectful. Well, you can change your timekeeping. Mm-hmm. But if I go and say, Joe, you're lazy, you're always late, I'm attacking you as a person.
Person, yeah.
So challenge behaviours, not the personality behind it, is another reason why translating a value into a trademark behaviour means that you can be challenged on it without feeling personally affronted.
Well, let's pick up on this bit then, because you're talking about like culture as well. You kind of reference culture there, and you've written so many business books, and it reminds me, it's one of my favorite ones, actually, favorite business book, actually, is The Barcelona Way.
Yeah,
that you've written, and where you unlock the DNA of high performing teams and cultures, because Barcelona FC are famed for the winning culture, aren't they? And
yeah, I think, or they were.
Well, they were, yeah.
Yeah.
Generally, they've been famed.
No, well, of course, yeah. Sorry, I'm being facetious, yeah.
Haven't they? Yeah, yeah. And I think what really struck me about that and what was fascinating about it is when you kind of see the title of the book and you think, oh, this is about football, really. But a lot of it, it's not really about football. It's more to do with, like, your environment that you're in and, like, the environment in that context that the players are in and they operate in. And I've got a couple of questions as well from some of the listeners as well.
All right,
and it might just be quite a nice time to tie this one in, because one of the listeners is a chap called Chris Taylor, and he's a 26-year-old entrepreneur, and he's scaling he does a lot of social media, like content marketing work for organisations and individuals. And as he's scaling his business, he wanted to know, and this ties in quite nicely, when it comes to building a high performing team, because that's what he's kind of going from, kind of being himself and then like the next level up, and now it's scaling rapidly. What's most important to kind of consider both in terms of as you're trying to recruit people into the business and you're scaling and you're creating a high performing culture?
Yeah. Oh, well, it's a brilliant question from Chris. So thanks for sharing it, Joe. I think the first thing is when we talk about culture, stop talking about culture is the first handy step, because culture doesn't mean a great deal, or it does, but it's different and it's subjective. So if we were to go out to your listeners and ask a dozen of them, define culture, I guarantee we'll get a dozen different definitions.
Yeah.
So you go, well, hang on a minute. We need to start then by making sure we have a shared definition. So what I find more helpful as a starting point, maybe for Chris or for any other listeners on this, is what type of culture have you got is a more helpful conversation. So you go, well, what does that mean? Well, this is research from two guys at Stanford called Barron and Hannon, two organizational psychologists is where this is referenced from. But what they did was years ago, they went into Silicon Valley, over 300 startup businesses, and they looked at what happens when you roll the dice in terms of culture, if you don't harness it. And what they found is if you almost take a chance, you'll get one, traditionally, you'll get one of five different types of cultures emerge as a consequence. So what are they? Well, the first type of culture is a star culture, where you just throw a load of money at it, recruit the best people you can, and just hope that they get on well. The second type you'll get is an autocratic culture. So it might be the founder, like in Chris's case here, he just sets the tone and it's my way or the highway. You either follow my lead or you don't.
Yeah.
Stay here. The third type of culture you get is a bureaucratic culture. So you can just go after loads of rules and regulations, have policies and procedures for everything. When you make a decision, you get everyone together in a committee and you try and reach a consensus. The fourth type you get is an engineering culture, where it's not about engineering, but it's about technical expertise. So you bring people in because they've got a deep knowledge in a narrow domain, a skill set. But what's been evidenced is the most successful culture, the most sustainably successful culture, is the fifth type, and that's called a commitment culture. And a commitment culture is basically, it answers two questions. It has a really clear sense of purpose. Why do we exist? What's our objective? What do we do? And the second one is, what are the rules of membership? So what are our behaviors that define the membership here? So to go back to the original question then for Chris, I'd say I would hazard a guess without speaking to him that he would go, I want the fifth type of culture. If that's the one that's going to sustain success, that's what I'm trying to build. So if that's the case, and if it's not, if he goes, oh, I'm happy with an autocratic culture, well, just crack on and just set the tone yourself. But if it's a commitment culture, the first one is you have to be able to have this clear sense of purpose, this mission, or in your language, your mojo, what is it that fires you up?
Yeah.
But then you have to go back to behaviors. And a nice way of establishing behaviors is, I do a really simple exercise when I work with teams on this and say, when you're good, why are you good? And everyone goes, what? You say, tell me what good looks like in your world. Like, give me examples. You set the rules. So it might be like in a customer service business, you say, who's your best customer? Who's the best customer you do the most business with that you enjoy doing it? Or it might be tell us your best quarter results, or tell me the best year success you've ever had. You set the term and then say, and what was happening then? So rather than take it for granted, say, explore it and tell me what behaviors were consistently present when you're good, when success follows. And what you'll get from that is a series of behaviors. Then you say, what are the three that are most important? What are the three that every time we do it, also with our talent, we actually end up being successful? That's then a decent starting point of establishing your rules for culture. And then in Chris's case there, what that then says is, if you're confident that they're the behaviors that are going to bring you success, are you recruiting people into your business based on those behaviors? Once you know they've got the technical competence, do you reward people? Do you pay people bonuses on the back of this?
Yeah.
Do you promote people because they demonstrate those behaviors? And then just as significantly, do you exit people from your business if they don't respect those behaviors? And only then, when you start looking at how they seep into every aspect of your decision-making, would you walk away from a customer that doesn't respect the behaviors, for example? When you start to see that they basically infiltrate every aspect or every decision that you make within your business, then you start the process of embedding a commitment culture that will give you the best guarantee of success.
And that's your DNA then. So it's in everything that you're doing, isn't it? So whatever products you're building, the people that you're hiring into the business, your team, your workplace, but what you're also saying is your customers as well, being brave enough to not
maybe work
with a
customer. Well, we had an interview recently.
100%.
Like, a good example of this was we recently interviewed Mary Portas, you know, the retail guru. And she told me a brilliant story when we were chatting about the company Patagonia. They do sort of like outdoor wear. And she said, in 2019, they did an advert, you know, like the Black Friday sales, when Black Friday is big boom period for retail. So Patagonia put out an advert, said they weren't doing Black Friday sales, but they put out an advert that said, you don't need a new coat.
Yeah,
just fix the one you've got.
I remember seeing it. Yeah.
Just repair the one you've got. Yeah. Now, you go, why were they doing that when they're in the business of selling coats? Well, one of their non-negotiable behaviours is sustainability.
Yeah.
So you can't say to people, oh, we believe in sustainability, and then jump on board a bandwagon just to flog you more tar. The power of that message of going, you don't need to buy a new coat off us. Just fix the one you've got. It's good enough.
Yeah.
Says something about the values of that business and how they behave, which Mary Portas was saying, sales have just gone through the roof because consistency and transparency. They've told you what they stand for, and then they behave like that. They don't turn a blind eye to it because I can make a few quid on a Black Friday. They'd like that even if it does cost them money. So I think living these behaviours in every way possible is then where you start to have a commitment culture.
Amazing. Amazing. And actually, I think that can apply to yourself as an individual, can't it? Like, commitment's 100%. Massive, I think. You know, committing to yourself first with a lot of this stuff is, I think it's one of the things that it's a coaching question I always ask clients at the end of when we say, you know, they're agreeing actions are going to take. And then, like, the first question is, how committed are you on a scale of 1 to 10 taking this action?
Well, I'll tell you, like, because when I'm doing the podcast, I see it as like free coaching for me. So I'm sat there with these brilliant brains and I'm like, can I ask you a question about this? And I asked a fellow the other day, this billionaire philanthropist, right? I said, can I ask you a question, Ricky? He went, yeah, what? I said, I'm rubbish at saying no to people. I said, I find it really hard to say no. And I know you're the same where if somebody says, Damien, can you help me with this? My first answer is always, yeah. And then I try and work out how I can. But I come from a place of just wanting to help and
people.
Do the right thing. But it sometimes comes at a personal cost. Do you know what I mean? To your own time or your health or your energy. Sometimes I do it. And I said to him, how do I get better at being more discerning without, because I don't want to change who I am and I don't think I can. So it's more about how do I get better at it? And he said, I get loads of people coming to me saying, can you help? And he said, I'll tell you the trick that I've learned best. I'm like, what is it? He said, I always say to them, I'd love to help you. He said, write me a 4-page report on how you think I can help you, but then what you're going to contribute to that relationship. He said, send me the 4-page report. I'll have a read of it. And then we'll come back and come up with a plan. And he went, 98% of people never come
back.
Don't
do it. Yeah.
Which he then says, tells you that what they were asking for really was, how can you help me? How can you do all the work in this relationship? Which isn't what I was signing up for, but that was his way of
Brilliant.
Just testing the strength of it. And I was like, oh, I like that.
So, I like that.
Yeah, so you can have that one. But but I think it's true. I think, but your point is true that this stuff we're talking about here is about, we're not just talking like a commitment culture for a team or an organization. It's for our lives as well. That very quickly, if we say, these are my standards, and that doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means that you're not right to be in my life at this moment in time. And it doesn't mean we have to fall out or be antagonistic to each other, but maybe our relationship just isn't in the right place for us to carry it on. And that's fine as well.
I love that because, you know, working with lots of pretty stressed and almost burnt out executives or entrepreneurs, it's all this stuff that goes on for people where maybe you feel like you can't say no, or maybe actually you're lacking a bit of confidence or self-belief and stuff, and it's really dysregulating for you. And it just kind of tees up some other stuff which is around personal performance. How do you, so I've got another couple of questions actually, and it was a similar question that came from two other like amazing women who were pretty much start, well, one of them, Sasha Saville, she owns an outsourcing solutions agency. And I know she started this during the pandemic and she's been scaling it like brilliantly. And then Helen Crespo, she's got a network marketing business that she runs alongside her corporate job, and they're both achieving lots really quickly. And they're learning at the same time as well. So you're doing this, aren't you? You know, to get to high point, you've got to be learning all the time, haven't you? And you're going to have ups and downs and things that you feel that you're not winning at or you're failing at. And
100%.
What they were asking, similar question really, it's a question about high performance and burnout. Have you got any tips on how do you sustain these levels of high performance without burning yourself out? Are there any sort of things to be aware of that people need to...
Yeah, massively. So is this both Sasha and Helen asking?
Both Sasha and Helen have asked the same question, yeah.
Right, okay, that's really interesting because if you permit me, I'll tell you a personal story that doesn't reflect well on me on this, but the reason I'll share it is because I'm not particularly good at protecting myself from burnout. So I'll tell you two stories that illustrate it. First one was this is nearly, 16, 17 years ago. I was doing a corporate job and I misunderstood the rules of engagement, right? I threw myself into it. I threw myself with such passion and fury and just I loved it. And I ended up getting myself really quite seriously ill. I just worked myself to a frazzle and I ended up getting myself run down. And when I was run down, I was saying to myself, just man up, get on with it, stop whinging, just go on, you just embrace the grind, all that nonsense. And I was saying all this to myself, and I pushed myself past so many red flags that were saying, you're going to get poorly here.
Yeah.
And in the end, I crashed and burned quite badly, where I remember going to a doctor one day, and I had this persistent cold, and I couldn't shake it off. And I turned up, and he went, have you had a look at yourself, mate? I was like, what do you mean? He was like, you burnt out. He went, you're just on the verge of a breakdown. I can see it. And I come out and I was like, what does he know? Bollocks. And carried on. A long story short, I ended up getting rushed into Crumsall Hospital, right? With meningitis, right?
Wow.
So I ended up getting taken in, that my immune system was that shot to bits that I was going to get ill from something. And I just happened to trip up and get meningitis. And, when they were doing the lumbar puncture, right, this is all in hindsight, you know, the lumbar puncture where they put the needle in your spine,
nice,
right? Oh, no, well, I'm a coward as well, so it's worse. So
nice.
I was crying, right? I was literally blubbing like a baby when they were doing it. And my girlfriend at the time, she's my wife now, she didn't want to stand there and see that undignified sight. So she went out and found my boss from where I was, right? And she only told me this in hindsight, but the first question my boss asked when she said, oh, he's seriously ill in the hospital, he's just having a lumbar punch, he's got meningitis. First question my boss said was, is it contagious? Do we have to shut the site down? Right. And then it took them 3 days to phone back up afterwards and find out whether I was still alive or not.
God.
Right. Now, my wife didn't tell me this at the time. She told me when I was getting better. And my first reaction was like, how dare they do that? And I was bitter and I was furious and things like that. But then when I calmed down, I went, you know what? It's my mistake, not theirs. And the mistake I realized was I applied meaning to something when they didn't have the meaning to it. To them, I was a number. To them, as long as I was hitting the numbers and doing what I needed to do, I was doing my part of the job. But in my head, what had fueled me doing this was, this really matters. This is about making a difference. I'm loving it and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd apply the meaning, not them. I changed the rules of the game in my head. They didn't change. They were consistent.
Yeah.
And what I always say is that was the catalyst for me to set up my own business. But I was frightened to death that I mentally resigned 18 months before I physically followed through and set up my own business to do it. So I thought that I thought I'd learned a lesson, and I didn't. I set up my own business and as a consultancy and worked my nuts off for years. And again, allowed that same narrative to kick in, just man up, get on with it, you know, make the sacrifices, do what you've got to do. And again, I took myself right to the edge of getting quite seriously ill again. This is more recent now. And I think what it led me to understand is, I'm offering those two stories, not as a woe is me, but as an example of, I ignored it twice and got burnt twice for it. So if this helps Sasha and Helen and anyone else listening, what I've reflected on is, and it was only when I had children that I remember somebody saying to me, how would you feel if someone spoke to your children in the way that I was speaking to myself?
Yeah.
And it knocked the wind out of my sails, and I thought I'd be horrified. And it made me quite emotional, the idea that anyone would say to my two kids, get on with it, stop whinging, man up, when they were in obvious pain or when they were exhausted. And what it forced me to understand was, I lack kindness, and kindness got to start with yourself. You can't be kind to others if you don't have the capacity to be kind to yourself. Sometimes you've got to just take an eight count. Sometimes you just got to take a break and go, you've done the best you can with what you've got in the moment you're in, but you need a rest.
Yeah.
You need to, if you can't be kind to yourself, you don't have the capacity to be kind to others. So what I would say to Sasha and Helen is, get rid of this sort of toxic self-talk of, you've got to be, like, I hate all this bullshit you're hearing. You've got to be hustling all the time.
I hate it as
you've
well.
You've got to be 24/7, that you never rest. And like, I think it's destructive, but I think it's poisonous as well. And what I would say is, I fell for it twice and got burnt badly twice. Don't make the same mistake. Be kind to yourself. Start by, a non-negotiable has to be kind to yourself. And being kind to yourself sometimes means doing nothing, switching off, having a night off, you know, giving yourself time, giving yourself permission to fail. Because if you're not doing that, I promise you, based on my experience and plenty of others I've spoken to, it's going to bite you on the arse at some stage, that lack of kindness.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I call it winning you in a game first.
No, I like that. That's
and I do that with, and I talk about this a lot with business owners and startups, because that was me as well, actually, what you've just described. I've been
was it?
A very similar thing. Yeah, very, very similar. And it's the inner chit chat, isn't it, that it causes stress that we don't realise activating at the level of thoughts, and it sends your body into, you're running it in a stress pattern. And when you're doing that, all you're lowering your immune system. You know, it's the fight or flight, actually, that we're living in for a prolonged 100%. Period of time. Yeah. And but I always then, say that but then, too.
But then terminology like kindness or just like, again, I think it's controlling that narrative of going, kindness doesn't mean you're soft. Kindness doesn't mean that anything other than you just have a degree of empathy and understanding for yourself. Do you know what I mean? Like a big decision for me a couple of years ago was, I came off social media, right? Because I read this brilliant quote from a guy called Bill Bullard, right? And it says, opinion is the lowest form of knowledge.
Mm.
Empathy is the highest form of knowledge, because empathy forces you to suspend your ego, to step into somebody else's world and to see it from their perspective. Opinion just means you just say, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have made that mistake. And increasingly I was coming to the view of, but why would you be on it? And I'd kidded myself, oh, I could do with it for business. It doesn't help do thing well. And in the end, it was like, I can't give a fuck about that. It's more damaging to put yourself in a world of just people's opinions than it is to step away and immerse yourself in a world of empathy and understanding and kindness of people that understand your story, your struggle, what you're trying to achieve, rather than get caught up in this narrative of, you've got to be hustling, you don't stop, it's not, you know, you're always working, if you're always selling. And it's on it sort of exasperates me.
Me too, the whole hustle, grind 24/7, the I only need 4 hours sleep. Oh. I mean, it's just not sustainable, is it? You know, you need.
No.
I mean, because certainly, you know, you've worked as a coach as well, don't you? With athletes and sports teams, and it must be like foundational stuff. Must be like having enough sleep, getting good quality sleep, feeding your brain and your body in the right way, having the right mindset, being able to, again.
Well, I was talking to a lad recently that he's a world champion boxer, and I was doing some work with him. And the question I asked him was, like, because he was in lockdown, he was fighting for a title earlier this year, but he had to go into a hotel and quarantine for the week beforehand. So I was saying to him, I said, in that week when you're going to be in the hotel, when you're sort of like tapering down your training camp, I said, are you going to be eating a load of shit? Like hamburgers and chips and like all sweet stuff. Are you going to be? And he went, no, of course I'm not. I've got to maintain weight and things like that. I said, right, okay, good. So you understand that on a physical level. I said, what are you doing with your phone? And he found himself on social media. I said, you're feeding your brain shit. Yeah. You're just feeding constant opinions of people that don't know you, but have got an opinion on you. You're reading stuff from people that know nothing about your struggle, what you're trying to do, the pressures that you're under, but have got an opinion on what they think about you. And I said, and it's the equivalent of sort of sabotaging yourself in the week leading up to the biggest test of your life today. But I also think, I mean, that had a defined endpoint in his case, but that's just as applicable for any of us. Why would you drive your car with the handbrake on? But how many of us are living our lives with the handbrake of other people's opinions, eating away at our self-esteem or what we're trying to do? Don't do it. Have the courage to step away from it. So I don't know if that helps Sasha and Helen with some as I'm basing it on my own cock-ups and mistakes, of which there are many, but I hope that they can sort of apply it and don't end up crashing and burning like I did.
Yeah, and I would say it's wisdom, isn't it? That, you know, the things that you can pass on and, you know, that learning and those experiences. And with that, I think there's, you know, this theme about resilience as well. And so for you, what is resilience for you? How do, because people talk about this a lot, and I've heard this. It was like a real flavour of something in the corporate world as well, you know, like being resilient and resilience training and all of that.
Oh, well, that's a pet hate of mine, right, Jo? Because I'll get calls sometimes off businesses and you sort of have a chat with them and you say, how can I help you? And they go, we want to do resilience training for our staff. Yeah. And the first response I will always say is, well, I've never met anyone that needs to be resilient in the face of kindness and decency and empathy. I've never met anyone that says, well, I need to armor plate myself against that.
Yeah.
But I've met loads of people that need to be resilient in the face of dickhead behavior and bullying and toxicity. Exactly. I know loads of people that then have to sort of steel themselves against that, but never kindness or empathy. So my first question is, have you genuinely got a resilience problem amongst your staff? Or is it a cultural problem that are you basically trying to armor plate people from the dickheads that you're allowing to prosper within your workplace?
Yeah.
Which then forces them to go, oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. And the answer is there is no answer. It will always be dependent on the situation. But I always think resilience training is always like putting a sticking plaster over a gaping wound.
It is, yeah.
Because we're all resilient. We've all found ways of getting through that. Like, I love that quote sometimes that you've survived 100% of your worst days.
Yeah.
We all have.
Yeah. So
we've all got a level of resilience. Don't get me wrong, we can enhance it and we can make it better and we can improve it. And there's tricks and tips and techniques we can use. But sometimes I think within cultures that it's a first resort and it should actually be a last resort to give people those kind of tools.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay. And so finally then, Damien, if there was one thing that somebody could start doing to unlock this, because I believe everybody's got it within them, like the potential for hyper. It's about unlocking it and how do you do that? What would you suggest somebody could start doing to unlock and unleash this inner potential for high performance that they have?
Right. Okay. So again, I think the first thing is work out that there's no point climbing a ladder to get to the top and realize it was leaning against the wrong wall. So there's no point in being high performing something that you're not that bothered about, so it felt a slog. So before you even start talking about high performance, work out what do you love doing? What do you want to be a high performer in? What are you prepared to invest your time and your energy and your focus on? So you have to know what do you love? What lights you up? What to use your language again, just what gets your mojo going? Because there's no point in doing it otherwise. It will inevitably at some stage feel like a slog. So once you've identified what you want, and more importantly, why do you want it? Success on your terms, however you do it. A really neat way of then doing it is conducting there's a psychologist called Gary Klein uses a really lovely technique called the pre-mortem. And a pre-mortem says, now I know where I want to get to. What could kill me? What could go wrong? What are all the things that are likely to derail my journey to success? And then work out how you're going to handle them when they happen, because they will happen.
Yeah.
There's another concept known as Cantor's Law in psychology that says in the middle of any project or any journey, there will come a moment where it looks and feels like a failure. And this is where things go wrong. And if you've not anticipated it, you panic and you go, oh, it's not for me. If you know it's going to happen, you see it as a stage along the way rather than a full stop. It's a comma. It's a moment to pause. So make time. Once you've identified where you want to get to and why you want to get there, work out what could stop you along the way. And the combination of those two factors, I sometimes call it when I work with a client, I say visualization and catastrophization. Combine them, you improve your resilience, which is what we're just talking about. The evidence says it's around 32%. But then I'll give you an example. When we interviewed Kelly Holmes on the podcast, she spoke about this and I said, how much difference do you think it made to you? Her estimate was it was an 80% difference.
Wow.
But the papers on this suggest it's somewhere in the region of 32% improvement. But regardless, you're still going to get better at dealing with the setbacks that inevitably occur on your way to your own destination. So if there was two bits of advice rather than the one you asked for, identify where you want to get to and why, and then work out what could kill you along the way. The combination of those two things could be really powerful.
Absolutely love that. Excuse me, nuggets of absolute gold in that. Thank you so much. So if people want to come and connect with you, because you've got a new book coming out as well, haven't you, all around high performance. So
That's
tell everybody, how can we find you? Where can we come and hunt you down and connect with you?
The easiest way is I've got a website called liquidthinker.com. So it's liquidthinker.com. There's a contact page there. So if there's any questions that they might have on the back of this, or they want to ask for a bit more information or whatever the reason might be, if you go to a contact page, it gets passed on to me. So I will read it. And if I can help, I will do. I might not come back and ask you to write a 4-page report. I've not applied that learning yet, but I will help. If I can help anybody, I certainly will. So if anyone wants to get in touch, I'm more than happy to pick up that.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being
here. Oh, I've loved it, Joe. Honestly, Joe, I know you cover this on the podcast, but I think your own story is incredible. I think the courage that you've demonstrated to pivot, you know, to set up the coaching work that you do, the podcast, I do have an appreciation of how much courage it takes, how much hard work and how much discipline and dedication. So thanks for having me on. It's a real honour, but congratulations on everything you've done. I feel a real buzz when I see how successful you're being and the difference you're making. So well done.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so kind of you. You've been listening to the Mojo Matters podcast with Joe Britton. Tune in again for more practical advice on how to find your mojo and how to keep it.